168?
Yes.
Are you coming over from Stark's course?
Yeah. Okay.
This is the first lecture. I had an informal discussion on Friday, and I printed out. All right, so I think I'll get started. Here's the syllabus. Does anyone have something that has a syllabus? So this course is Math 168, and it's going to be an introductory course on some fairly advanced topics that are at the forefront of research. But it's a course that won't assume too much background in your part, and it's a course about elliptic curves and modular forms. So these are the sorts of objects that came up a lot in the proof of Fermat-Lasse theorem, and also the sorts of objects that I personally enjoy computing with very much. What I'm going to do today, after briefly discussing the syllabus, is give kind of an overview lecture. And the rest of the course is going to be devoted to filling in the details of this overview lecture. Also, if time permits, at the end I'm going to give you a demo of a computer algebra system that I'm writing, and that I hope if any of you have interest might want to help me with the writing of. So I'll start with the syllabus. The course meets here, and it's only on Monday and Wednesday, so don't bother coming on Friday. I won't be here. There's a section at 5 p.m. on Thursdays, and I'll be the person leading the discussion section. Let's see, the course website's listed here, so I'll just show you the course website really quickly. So here it is. So each day I'll try to type up notes and hopefully hand them out to you if possible. So for example, here are the notes for today. There's the syllabus. So in the course there'll be one midterm. I just popped up the notes. I'll discuss grading in a second. There'll be one midterm. I have a list of references here. So far it's not very big. I just have one little paper, but I'll have a lot more added there. Homework assignments are here, so you can see it. Homework will be handed out on Wednesdays and then due the following Wednesday. Which, come to think of it, it's kind of dumb because the discussion section is on Thursday. It might actually make a lot more sense now that the course has changed to Monday, Wednesday, from Monday, Wednesday, Friday, to hand out the homework on Monday and make it due the following Monday. Right? Just because then you can do it over the weekend and you can ask the questions during the Thursday discussion section. So, what do you think of the two? I mean, homework due Wednesday versus homework due Monday. Who wants homework due Wednesday? Monday. Okay, Monday. So, homework I'll give the first assignment on Wednesday, but it'll be due on Monday. That way you can ask me questions on Thursday and you have the weekend. This is an MP3 recorder, so I'll record the audio of all the lectures. The only problem with that is that it's hard to remember to turn it on. So if you see me up here and it's not here and on, let me know, and then I'll remember to turn it on. So this is useful if you miss a class. Here I'm going to post a list of open problems as I think of them that are somehow relevant to discussion in course. So if there's a problem that comes up and I don't know the solution, and this happens occasionally, then I'll post it here and you can kind of scan this, and obviously solving one of these would be very good. Some of them might be very difficult. I did this during the last course I taught, and this guy started sending me solutions to some of the problems I didn't know the answers to. And he was a guy who, he was an undergrad and he got kicked out of Harvard because his grades weren't good enough in his other classes. So he was had to spend a year off, so he was spending it trying to solve the problems I put on the website. Also, if you send me questions that are related to the course, I'll post them to what's called virtual office hours, which will be right here when you've actually sent me some questions. And what will happen is you can see the question that was asked, and you can see my response. Here is a person that's been. So you'll see the question and the response, and here will be listed there. So say somebody asked the following question. So you can benefit from seeing what everybody else's questions are. And by asking a question, the whole class benefits because they get to see what the question was and what the answer is. This is obviously outdated. I need to change that because it's moved to right now so as to not conflict with Stark's course. Okay, so that's the website. The main topics, again, are elliptic curves and modular forms from a very introductory point of view. The prerequisites, it would be very good if you know what group strings and fields are. There's one person here who hasn't had a lot of exposure to that, so I'm going to try to work with you. So with Naki, right?
Right.
Okay. You should be able to follow proofs. So if I prove something, you should know what a proof is and have written a proof sometime in your life. And you should know how to use a computer. Everybody knows how to use a computer. Some old mathematician told me to put that on syllabi when you actually require the use of computers somewhere in a course. Okay, so grades, I think because there are both, the course is maybe a third undergraduates and the rest are graduate students, the gradient's going to be completely different for grad students than undergraduates. So what's listed under 4 is how grades will be decided for the undergraduates. And I think for graduate students, I'll have to think about this a little further, but basically it'll be an everybody who's a grad student gets an A type thing. So, unless you don't do anything, I'll probably require a final project, but unless you do something really lame, then you'll get an A. As an undergrad, I'll have the grading standard that's listed here. But as an undergrad, you know that you don't have to compete with graduate students in any way for your grades. It's a completely separate thing. Okay. Homework, also if you're a graduate student, you should do the homework assignments, but again, as long as you put in a reasonable effort, you're going to get an A as a graduate student. So the undergrads, on the other hand, you'll have to do sort of a certain percentage of the work as indicated. Okay, regarding the homework, so in some courses you might have been told not to work together on assignments. You're very, very strongly encouraged to work together on homework assignments and talk about the problems with each other. The only caveat is that you should attribute who helps you on homework. Office hours. I haven't set office hours yet because it was unclear when the course would be held or how many people would be here, etc. And I will do that in the future after polling you to find out what your schedules are like and what I'm going to do as the semester progresses. But my office is in APNM. It's on the 5th floor in room 5111. And anytime I'm there, feel free to come by and just chat with me. But I will set some official office hours when I will be there. By the way, how many office hours are typical for a professor at UCSD? Like, per week?
Two or three?
Two or three?
I think it's an hour in class, or an hour out of class.
Okay, so it's a 3-hour class, therefore 3 hours would be typical for this class. Okay. Okay, I'll keep that in mind. Okay, finally there's a course outline. This should roughly correspond, they're not quite to the lectures I will give. So for example, today is number 1. And tomorrow Wednesday will be about the group law, how to put a group structure on the points of an elliptic curve, and so on down the list. You can see that there are only 15 lectures listed here, and there are more than 15 lectures in the course, so sometimes I will spend more time on a particular topic. You could spend several weeks just rigorously defining elliptic curves, and I'm not going to go into a lot of pedantic detail about algebraic curves and then elliptic curves and so on. I'll give you a lot of examples, I'll show you explicit computations with these objects, and I'll talk about how they come up in cryptography and other areas of mathematics. Okay, so that's the course outline. And I've now gone over the syllabus. Are there any questions about the syllabus or the course in general? Okay. Okay, so now we'll going to go through the lecture that I've written for today. So an outline of both the course and the lecture. I'll begin with a little bit of motivation about Pythagorean triples and Fermat's last theorem. That's just a few minutes at the beginning of this lecture. Then I'll talk about a third of the course and about half of this lecture about Mordell day groups of elliptic curves and the Bergen-Sorensen-Dyer conjecture. So that's a lot of stuff. But that's what I'll start with. Then I'll talk about what it means for an elliptic curve to be modular. This is a big theorem that Weyl has proved elliptic curves in Mercure are modular. And finally, I'll talk about computing modular forms. For an elliptic curve to be modular means it comes from a modular form. An independent question that arises is how can you compute all the modular forms? For example, the ones that give rise to elliptic curves. So that's what this is about. So let's start at the beginning. So long ago, Pythagoras enumerated triples of integers a, b, and c with a squared plus b squared equals c squared. And if you look at these old Babylonian tablets, here's an example of one. It has a list of Pythagorean triples. The triples that I've listed down the side are not the same ones that are on here. The ones that are on here are much more impressive. They're quite large. The ones on the side are just the triples up to about, they're the first few triples if you systematically enumerate them. So for example, 3 squared plus 4 squared is 5 squared. 5 squared plus 12 squared is 13 squared. 25 plus 144 is 169, and so on. So I systematically enumerated a bunch here. If you look at this tablet in base 60, you'll find much larger triples that were enumerated in some way, possibly in the following way. So here's a method that allows you to find all solutions to the equation a squared plus b squared equals c squared. All solutions subject to the condition that a, b, and c be relatively prime. There's no common factor of all three of them. So here's what you do. You consider a circle of radius 1. So that's a solution of x squared plus y squared equals 1. And there's a point on it, namely the point minus 1, 0. And what you do is you draw a line of slope t through that point. It will intersect the circle in exactly one other point, unless the slope is infinity. But for any finite slope, it intersects at exactly one other point. And then you solve for the coordinates of the other point, x and y. And here's what you end up getting. At the top, that's the equation for the line of slope t. It's y equals t times the quantity x plus 1, if you like, multiplying both sides through. It's the line of slope t that goes through that point. But if you solve for x and y, here's what you get. And now if you substitute in a value for t, you can add those in x and y. And notice that x and y are rational numbers if t is a rational number. Conversely, anytime x and y are rational numbers, if you draw the line, the slope t, that goes through the point x, comma y, and minus 1, 0, that line will have rational slope. Because after all, if you can give the slope of that line, it's rational since it's the differences of the y's over the differences of the x's, which is rational. So then you substitute it in, and you get rational numbers. So the rational numbers t correspond exactly to the points on the circle, and those correspond to solutions to the equation x squared plus y squared equals 1. Now, clearing denominators, which is what you get here, if you write t as r over s, then you get that a squared, where a squared is given by this, b squared is given by that, and c squared is given by that. Sorry, c is given by that. You get that a squared plus b squared equals c squared. So all I've done here is written t equal to r over s, substituted that in to give x and y up there, and then consider the equation x squared plus y squared equals 1 in clear denominators. And this is what you get. So by running through different possibilities for r and s, hence different possibilities for t, you run through the possibilities for a, b, and c to satisfy the equation a squared plus b squared equals c squared. So this illustrates a basic question that motivates number theory. Given an equation, an algebraic equation, such as a squared plus b squared equals c squared, systematically enumerate solutions, systematically list solutions. So that's the case of 2. The next simple case you might consider is systematically enumerate solutions to x to the, maybe x cubed plus y cubed equals z cubed, where you want, again, x, y, and z to be integers. Maybe I'll even use the same letters before a, b, and c. So systematically enumerate solutions to this. And then if you could do that, you could do it with fourth powers, fifth powers, sixth powers, and so on.
For example, with fourth powers, you could rewrite this as a squared squared plus b squared squared equals c squared squared. And you notice that if ever you have a solution to this equation, then it was a solution to the original, it was a Pythagorean, you would have had a Pythagorean triple where the three numbers appearing in the Pythagorean triple are each themselves squares. So if you look at the list of Pythagorean triples I made before, do you have any examples like that? Let's look back. Are there any examples where all three are perfect squares? And also, it's sort of a number theory question. Are there any Pythagorean triples where all three are perfect squares? There aren't any in our list. And in fact,
the Fermat proved via infinite, something that's called infinite descent, that there are no solutions to this with a, b, and c all positive integers. So in fact, it's a theorem that there are no triples of Pythagorean, there are no Pythagorean triples where all three numbers are squares. It's a non-trivial thing to show. But in fact, there are no solutions to this at all. You require a, b, and c to be positive integers. Likewise, for exponent 3, there are no solutions if you require these to be positive integers. And these are two facts that were observed long, long ago.
And then the general question arises,
well, what about if you put an n here instead of just a 3? So if your n is an integer, a whole number, and n is greater than or equal to 3, do you ever have solutions where a, b, and c are all positive, and they're all integers? And Fermat conjectured around 1640 that, in fact, you don't. Yeah, he claimed to prove it and never wrote down the proof because there wasn't enough room right here. So this problem challenged mathematicians over several hundred years, and in fact motivated the development of I'd say a lot of algebraic number theory, and it culminated in 1995 when Andrew Wiles published a correct proof that there are no solutions to this equation subject to these conditions. It's a very deep proof, but it was the problem had become sufficiently famous that the fact that he had proved it was announced in the New York Times, so etc. Of course, that was announced in 1993 when he thought he had proved it. And some other people had thought that he proved it, and he had announced proving it, but there was a little manuscript that he circulated to his best friends, and they all looked at it and said, this is very complicated and it's wrong. So fortunately, Richard Taylor and Wiles subsequently cleaned up the proof and published a corrected proof. There's a nice movie about this. It's a Nova special that Simon Singh directed. Here's a picture of Wiles right here, by the way. That's Wiles. Okay, so Wiles' proof, the main reason I'm mentioning it is just to motivate, well, first, Fermat's theorem motivates the question of finding rational points, or integer points, on an object, that is, solutions in the integers to an equation. The proof, in fact, uses elliptic curves, even though at first it looks like it shouldn't. So let me tell you what an elliptic curve is. So here's a somewhat abstract definition. An elliptic curve is a non-singular plane cubic curve with a rational point, which you typically think of as being at infinity. So see if we can parse that. So non-singular means that if you graph the equation of the curve, if you graph the set of solutions to the curve, there are no self-intersections and there's no cusp. So it's sort of a calculus notion that you are probably familiar with. There are no places where there, it means that if you have an equation f of x, y equals zero, then it has no singularities at, say, well, the singular points are the points where df dx equals df dy equals f equals zero. So the solution, the common solution set to this, a set of points x, y for which all three of these are zero, those are the singular points on this curve. So for example, let's take the Fermat cubic curve,
which is in three variables, and see that it doesn't have any singular ones. So you take x cubed plus y cubed plus z cubed equals 0. Actually, I should have minus. So the Fermat cubic is x cubed plus y cubed equals z cubed. And you can view this as a curve by dividing through by z, and then you can think of it as the curve. If you give it, you can make a new variable, little x equals capital X over z, and little y equals capital Y over z, over capital Z. And then you get, by dividing through, you get the equation x cubed plus y cubed equals 1. And this is the equation of a curve. You could graph it in a plane. If you imagine graphing it, think of, you could try to solve for y, and at least you get a piece of the graph. It would be the graph of y equals cube root of 1 minus x cubed. So of course, you have to take into account the three cube roots. But we could graph this with a graph. The question is, does it have any singular points? So let's just do the calculus. So I'll let capital F be x cubed plus y cubed minus 1. And then let's consider this system of equations. The derivative with respect to x is 3x squared. The derivative with respect to y is 3y squared. And the original equation is x cubed plus y cubed minus 1. So does this have a solution? Are there any solutions to are there any x and y that satisfy all three of those equations? No. Because if x satisfies this equation, then x is 0. And if y satisfies it, then y is 0. But then that doesn't satisfy this, because you put 0 over here. Yeah. So this is an example of a non-singular curve. Okay, so back to our story. Here are some examples of elliptic curves. Everyone except the one with the big red mark through it. This is an example of an elliptic curve. It's a cubic curve. Each is a cubic curve. They're plane curves because they're in two variables. And the first three are non-singular. If you simply do the calculus exercise that I just showed you, you'll find that they're non-singular. And we did the second one. The problem with the third equation is that it doesn't have any points on it. It doesn't have a rational point. By rational point, I mean a solution, x, y, to the equation where x and y are both rational numbers. And if you understand a little projective geometry and know what it's meant by the point in infinity for this curve, then it also doesn't have a rational point in infinity. So you can try for a second to find rational x and y that satisfy this equation, or even integer x and y, and you won't find any. It's actually a non-trivial thing to show that there aren't any. By the way, here's an open problem, completely open problem, maybe at the core of number three. Given a plain cubic equation, like this, that or the other one, given an algorithm that decides, so I think I reversed the quantifiers there. Here's the question. Given an algorithm that takes as input a plain cubic equation, so just give the coefficients of the polynomial, and it outputs either yes or no. Either yes, there's a rational solution to the cubic equation, or no, there isn't. That's an open problem. We don't know how to give an algorithm that does that. There is, in fact, a conjectural algorithm, but it's not known determining. There's a procedure, which is fairly complicated. It's been very, very well refined over the years. But for all we know, it'll go forever and never terminate. So it's not an algorithm. So probably the right way to phrase the problem is prove that the conjectural procedure for deciding either yes or no, a plain cubic has a rational point. This one does, this one doesn't. Plain cubic has a rational point. Prove that the conjectural algorithm works. But it seems like a very simple question. That, I mean, it seems like one. You just have to give a program, you have to write a computer program that inputs a curve and outputs either yes or no, there's a solution. So what about if it were in one variable? Then would you know how to do it? Could you tell me whether a polynomial in one variable x, say integer coefficients, has a rational root? Is there an algorithm, a procedure that will always terminate and tells me yes or no? You seem to know. Or so
probably.
Yeah, right.
Zeros are the mean shift between them.
Yeah, yeah. So you would, let's see, yeah, so you could do that. Also, if you, well, any other ideas from way back, remember in high school when you found rational solutions to polynomials? Some condition that they satisfy. I mean, what you said would definitely work. I think there's another remark to me, which isn't as efficient, but just isn't. Yes?
Aren't there like a given set of possibilities there, last term in the
Exactly. There's a rational root theorem, a rational root test. We have this divisibility condition. And you could just check through, if you could factor the first coefficient and the last coefficient, you could check through the factors, for example, and you'd be able to go through all possibilities. It's simple if you have, you know, if you have a polynomial in one variable, f of x equals sum a n x to the n, and you have a rational root b over c, you plug it in, you get zero, then there'll be a divisibility condition on the leading coefficient and the constant coefficient involving b and c. So I won't go into the details of that. But it's pretty easy to decide whether or not, at least from an algorithmic point of view, there's a finite procedure that'll tell you either yes or no, there's a rational solution to a polynomial one variable. So the question is, what about two variables? And that's an open problem. So if you take a polynomial in two variables with integer coefficients, and you ask, is there a solution to f equals zero? What's the set of solutions? Is it empty or not? So here x and y are both fractions, rational numbers. So that's a hard problem.
What about for n bigger than 2?
Sorry, what?
Like 3 variables, 4 variables.
Yep, gets even harder. But sometimes it could be easier in more variables because you have more freedom. But I think it's just, in general, it can be pretty hard. So, yeah, but already 2 is a problem. So if 2 is a problem, right, well, it's going to be more of a problem. But you have more freedom because, for example, if you have 3 variables, you can choose anything you want for the third variable and try to look on this curve and see whether or not there's a solution. So you have more freedom there. Maybe there'll be some special curve in your family on your surface that works for which you can decide this. So often you can decide this for curves with certain properties. For example, here's a cubic curve, which you can very quickly tell me whether or not it has a solution. Actually, I'll make it even. Here's a quadratic, which you can very easily tell me. Does this have any rational solutions? No, because if you plug in rational numbers for x and y, you can't get a negative number here. So there are analogs of this for cubic curves, which are often useful. Instead of working over the real numbers and noticing it's something like this, you can work over the p-omic numbers or modulo p, and if you see that there are no solutions, then you're set. This curve is an example of a curve that it will have a solution modulo p for any prime number p. So this local obstruction looking modulo p does not allow you to rule out solutions to this equation. But many equations you can deal with in that way. You find a prime number p for which there's no solution, then you're done. There can't be a solution. Well, you have to worry a little bit about denominators and so on, but as long as you're careful, you can use methods like that. Okay, so now here's the structure of Weyl's proof of Fermat's last theorem. So here's a picture of Gerhard Frey, and I'll show you how that comes up. So here's the idea Frey had. He said, suppose Fermat's conjecture is false. Suppose there is a counterexample to Fermat's last theorem. Then you'd have a triple of positive integers, and you could assume that they're not all divisible by a single common factor, such that a to the l plus b to the l equals c to the l. I'm writing l here. To indicate that it should be a prime number, you can. It's fairly easy to reduce from the. If you could prove Fermat for a prime exponent, then you would immediately be able to prove it for composite exponents. You just factor. You just use that x to the n equals x to the. If n is well, this is, let me write, x to the n times n is x to the n to the l. So using this, you can take a counterexample with composite conductor and obtain from it a counterexample with prime, sorry, not conductor, a counterexample with composite exponent and obtain from that a counterexample with prime exponent. The only problem is when the exponent, when the prime exponent that you get is 2, but then you can deal with Fermat for exponent 4 directly, etc. So you can reduce to the case when the exponent is prime, and that prime is in fact greater than or equal to 5, because you can deal with the small values of L, or the small exponents directly. So then you consider this elliptic curve. This is a plane cubic curve. Here A and B are specific numbers, or specific numbers that appear as counterexamples to Fermat's theorem. And you just consider this curve. And again, it's an elliptic curve because, well, you have to check directly that it's non-singular, but you can do that. And it's certainly a cubic curve. If you multiply the right-hand side out, you get a cubic polynomial. So Ribbit proved that the word modular, the adjective modular, does not apply to this elliptic curve. He proved that this curve is not modular. So Ken Ribbit is a professor at Berkeley who does the Ribbit theorem. On the other hand, Wiles, with the help of Taylor, proved that this elliptic curve is modular. So there's a problem there, because a curve can't both be not modular and modular. Therefore, there was no counterexample to Fermat in the first place, and Fermat's conjecture must have been true. That's the very, very high-level structure of Wiles' argument. This is a recent photo of Fry. I took it of him in Overwolfach this summer. So we, at Overwolfach, they randomly distribute who you eat with during all the meals. So one day I was sitting next to him and his wife, and I'm like, all right, so that, again, that's the structure of the proof of Fermat's theorem. And much of this course is going to be about explaining what these statements mean. Not telling you how to prove them, just telling you what they mean. All right, so now I'm going to say just a little bit, I want to say a lot more about this next time, but about how if you have an elliptic curve, again, a plane curve that's non-singular and it's cubic and it has a point on it, then you can get a group. You can obtain a group. So here's how. Given 2 points on the curve, in this case red and green, you draw the line that they determine, and that will intersect the curve in exactly one other point. Because the curve is a cubic curve, you know, you have Bazout's theorem, which says that the number of intersection points counted with multiplicity is the product of the degrees of the two curves. So if you have a cubic curve and a line, which is a linear curve, the product of those 2 degrees is 3. 3 times 1 is 3. So the number of intersection points will be 3. You can also see that completely directly. Take the equation of a line, and you substitute it into this equation, and you'll find exactly 3 solutions, counting multiplicities. So that'll be an I think I'll put a problem like that on the homework at some point. So what I want to do to make a group, I have to tell you how to take 2 points in the curve and get a 3rd point that satisfies certain, that has certain properties. And I've already told you how to take 2 points and get a 3rd point. You just take the 3rd point of intersection. A problem with that, though, is you don't get a group. If you declare the operation to be take 2 points and you take the 3rd point of intersection, the resulting set set of points with that operation is not a group, does not form a group. Let's see how to. So, what would be a problem with that? So, if you have a group, it has to be the case that there's some point so that when you add it to anything, you get back the anything. So, it has to be a neutral element. And here, what the neutral element will be is a point at infinity on this curve. You can think of it as where these two branches come together. There's a very formal definition of what it is in terms of the projective plane, but suffice to say that if you take any vertical line at all, it intersects the elliptic curve at the point at infinity on the elliptic curve. So that's supposed to be the neutral element. So if we used this definition where you just take the 3rd point of intersection, let's see what happened. I guess that's okay. That doesn't present a problem. Well, some other axiom will fail. So
So what are the axioms of a group? You have to have an identity element, so when you add anything to it, you get the point, you get that anything back. So actually that works. If I were to define the group structure in such a way that the identity element is the point of infinity and I just take the third point of intersection, if I were to take this point and then add it to the point of infinity, the third point of intersection would be this point again. Oh, sorry. Here's a case where it's clearly fails. Take this point and add it to the point of infinity using the incorrect group structure where you just take the third point of intersection and you get the yellow point. So you add the point of infinity to this point, you would get the yellow point, which is a completely different point. So 0 plus other, something else would not be that something else. So it doesn't work. You do not get a group if you make the binary operation on the set of points on an elliptic curve. Just take two points and then take the third point of intersection. By the way, one really cool thing that we'll get when we put a group structure on the set of points on an elliptic curve is the following. Once you find one point, you can then, or say two points, you can use it to get a third point, and then you can keep iterating this process, and you get a whole bunch of points. In particular, you can take a point and add it to itself multiple times, and you'll get a huge number of points that are very hard to find if you didn't know about the group structure. Whereas if all you do is just do this secant procedure, you wouldn't get anything new. At this point, that point, and you just go back and forth. You don't get anything new from this. Okay, so that's not the way to make a group structure. The right way is you take the secant, and then you draw the line between this point and the point of infinity and look at the third point of intersection. So the red point plus the green point is the yellow point. That's the sum in the group operation on the set of points of an elliptic curve. You take the set of points on an elliptic curve and declare that a point plus another point is obtained by drawing a secant line and then taking the third point of intersection with the line through the to this intersection point and infinity, then you get a group structure. Showing that it's a group is actually pretty hard. You have to check that the identity element behaves correctly, and that works just fine. You have to check that it's that everything in the group maps into the group again, which is fine. The hard part is the associative law. It's actually very, very complicated. Somewhat complicated to check the associative law. At least if you try to check it directly by drawing pictures. The associative law falls out very naturally if you develop everything from the point of view of algebraic curves and divisors on curves and so on, but that's not what I'll do, except in passing. So this gives you a group structure. And an example is -1, 0 + 0, -1. The sum of those two points on the curve is this third point right here, which has coordinates 2, 2. And the neat thing, as we noticed before, when you add together two points, if both of them have rational solutions, if both of them have rational coordinates, the third one will have rational coordinates, which is pretty amazing. If you go to the next slide, what I've done is I've taken the single point 0, 0 and added it to itself. It's a group, so I can add it to itself over and over again, and I get tons and tons of points all over on the curve. Now, this doesn't really do justice. These points are extremely complicated looking if you actually write them down. I'm going to switch over to a computer program and show you what they actually look like when you compute them.
For a point added to itself, you take the tangent line?
Exactly, you take the tangent line. That's correct. Okay, so I've just entered this curve, and then I'll make the point 0, 0. And now, if you take the tangent line, you get 1, 0. Let's check that in the graph. So let's take the point 0, 0 and then add it to itself. So the limiting procedure here is to take the tangent line, then take the third point of intersection. That gives you this point right here. But then you take the other point of intersection with the line from here to infinity, and that gives you this point right here, which is 1, 0. And that's what the computers produced. 1, 0. But it's a group, and you have 3 times p, 4 times p, 2, -3, not quite as obvious of a solution. 5 times p is 1/4 - 5/8. 6/14. And they, in fact, get quite complicated as you continue. So they're getting more and more complicated. In doing this, I am systematically enumerating every single point on that particular curve. So the fact that this 1.00 is a generator for the group of points in that curve, it's a cyclic group with of infinite order. That's, again, something that requires some work to show.
Is that a special property of that curve? Or
yes. Yeah.
That's not true.
Not for every curve. In fact, if you take, well, I'm going to answer that question in much more length as this lecture progresses. So notice that the points get more and more complicated, like 50p, that's a very complicated point.
Does the new structure apply to the rational points as well?
I didn't quite understand the question.
So if you take an irrational point,
does it
still form a group under all real points?
So are you asking if you forget completely about the elliptic curve and just take... I don't really understand your question. Give me a few.
So you have this curve,
yes.
And you take, yes. You're taking two rational points.
That's right.
What if you choose an irrational point on the curve?
Ah, yes. You'll get back possibly irrational points.
Okay.
You can take any points at all. You take any curves of complex numbers.
Okay, the group structure still stands.
Exactly, yeah, it still stands. And in fact, if you were in Stark's lecture the previous hour, he mentioned, so if you weren't in that lecture, just completely ignore what I'm about to say, or don't get annoyed if you don't understand it, but he discussed a function p prime of z and another function p of z, and these were functions on the complex numbers that possibly end up pulls up some discrete set of points. And what he'll end up showing is that there's an equation of the form p prime of z cubed equals 4 p of z plus cubed. Sorry, this should just square. P prime of z squared equals 4 p of z cubed plus g. Well, I'll just say a p of z plus b. And notice that that's a cubic equation if you view it as y squared equals 4x cubed plus ax plus b. In fact, what you end up getting is that this Weierstrass p function defines a bijection between the points in a fundamental domain for where your Weierstrass p function and the solutions to a cubic equation where x and y are now allowed to be complex. And the set of points in the fundamental domain, that's a torus, so you get a group structure on it. It's isomorphic to C modulo a lattice. So in fact, if you take all complex solutions to this equation, so here I've just drawn the real solutions, they form a group, but you could actually consider x and y to be complex numbers, take all pairs of complex numbers that satisfy this equation, you get a group. That group is isomorphic via the Weierstrass p function to the complex numbers modulo a lattice, i.e. a torus, geometrically a torus. So there's a connection between the two points of view. Also, another interesting thing to do is, for example, don't take just fractions, just rational numbers, but take rational numbers and I, like Gaussian numbers, and allow the square root of minus 1. So take all numbers of the form a plus b I, where a and b are rational numbers. That forms a field. You can multiply such elements. You can take inverses. It's closed under those operations. You can take all solutions to this equation where a and b are rational. And so you take all solutions, x equals x is of this form and y is of this form, and you'll get a group. Because if you take any two points where the x and y coordinates are the form a plus bi for a and b rational, the resulting third point, when you do the algebra to get the yellow dot, the resulting third point will again have rational, will again be of that form. So in fact, as soon as you write down a single elliptic curve, you can take any field you want, and you get an abelian group associated to it. You get this group associated. So just write down, so associated to a curve, you have this huge family of groups. In fact, a good way to think about an elliptic curve is a systematic way of associating to number fields, say, or fields, a whole bunch of groups. Yes?
Some strange things happen in characteristic 2 and 3.
If you define elliptic curves correctly, the theory is identical. Everything works out just fine.
But they just take a different form.
Yeah, you can't all put them in this form. So the correct general form for a curve in any characteristic is, for an elliptic curve, in any characteristic is y squared plus a1 xy plus a3 y equals x cubed plus a2 x squared plus a4 x plus a6. So it's a theorem that if you have any cubic equation in two variables and there's at least one solution, then there's a way to transform that equation via some change of coordinates, like x goes to 1 over x or something. You can transform the equation to be of this form. And that works in any characteristic. In characteristic 0, you could take this and then complete the square and change things a little bit, and you end up getting something of the form y squared equals x cubed plus ax plus b. But that does not work in characteristic 2 or 3. I might even be able to demonstrate adding points over a bigger field here. So I made my curve. But we need a point that's defined over this field. So this curve is, that can be tricky. So we have to find some interesting point that has x and y coordinates that actually involves I in some non-trivial way. And there might not be any, I don't know. So it would be better to, I'll save this for later, but you can in fact do that. So anytime you have any elliptic curve defined by a, anytime you write down an equation like this, y squared equals x cubed plus ax plus b, you write down an equation like that where a and b are, say, integers, then via this procedure listed on the previous slide, you get a group. And in fact, it's an abelian group. And you can then, if you want, consider lots of different fields, such as to adjoin I, which is the set of numbers of the form A plus B I, with A being rational. And you get another situation, and you can consider all solutions X, Y that lie in here, and you get a group again. You can do this for infinitely many different fields. So you get a whole collection of fields associated to an elliptic curve. So here you get lots and lots of different rational solutions. If you draw the real graph of this elliptic curve, you'll notice that if you look really closely, it goes through lots and lots of rational points. In fact, the rational points are dense. It cuts through everywhere. If you look closely enough, you'll find rational points that lie on this graph. Take instead the curve y squared plus y equals x cubed minus x squared. It looks very similar. It's again an elliptic curve. Turns out it has only 5 solutions. That's all you'll find. It's just 5 solutions. There's an obvious point, 0, 0. And then if you add it to itself, you'll get the 5 different solutions. And that's it. You won't find any more. So it's kind of weird. Just a very slight perturbation in the equation, and you go from having it cut through infinitely many rational points in the plane to having it cut through very, very few. So a basic question is, what is going on here? It's sort of a mysterious behavior. And that's your question, right? You asked exactly that. What is your name?
Neil.
So first, just to put the question in a nice framework. Here's a beautiful theorem of Mordell. And it says that if you consider an elliptic curve and then take the group of solutions in the rational numbers to the elliptic curve equation, it's a finitely generated abelian group. That means that it's of the form z to the r plus torsion. So it's some finite number of copies of z plus torsion. Much more concretely, it means the following. If you give me any elliptic curve at all, there exists a finite list of points you could write down, in theory, so that every other point in the curve is got by just combining those points, by taking some linear combination of those points.
It's the analog of saying that somehow it's like a finite dimensional vector space as opposed to an infinite dimensional one. So that's really good to know because it means that there's not going to be some elliptic curve for which there's no chance of even writing down a finite list of points that give you everything. Any elliptic curve at all, there exists some finite list of points that you can get every point on the curve systematically just by taking combinations of those points. Now, another problem is, can you actually write these points down? So that's an algorithmic question. Does there exist an algorithm that takes as input an elliptic curve, say over Q, so it's just two numbers, and then it outputs a finite list of solutions to the equation so that every other solution to the equation can be got using this group operation. That is to say, using secants and tangent lines, secant lines and tangent lines, and taking the third point of intersection. That question is also open. But and again, there is a conjectural algorithm, a procedure that should work. We conjecture it works, but nobody's proved it works. By the way, the biggest R that's ever been found, people have systematically looked for elliptic curves for which the R is big. The biggest one found is at least 24. So that was found by some guys at the National Security Agency who were, for some reason, interested in finding such curves. I can't say anything about why. All that, just the fact they were looking, the one thing I can tell you is these have something to do with cryptography. Or at least they might. Okay. Here's another example. Here's a very simple looking equation. Y squared equals x cubed plus 7823. So it's just four digits that you type in. And in fact, for a long time, every curve of the form y squared equals x cubed plus d, people had found a list of points of every other point you could get from that list of points using the secants and tangent lines. Except this one remained. And I actually gave it to a student as a potential Westinghouse science project when she was in high school. I said, here's an equation, find a solution. And then she tried to look at all the theory. And in the middle of doing her project, this guy, Michael Stoll, in the upper right, found this point. And this is the simplest point. You can show that there's no other simpler point on here. There's no other simpler solution. So even to this very innocuous looking equation, the simple solution is huge. But you get every other point from this one. But it is a little bit annoying that they can be so big. They're usually not nearly this big, usually a lot smaller, but sometimes they can be huge. An interesting thing about this particular equation is that there's a very deep theorem of Gross and Zagier, so Benedict Gross and Don Zagier. And it's, in some sense, an explicit formula for a point that satisfies that equation. It's just that trying to, in practice, compute that formula to sufficient precision to see what the numbers are as rational numbers is quite difficult. What that formula will give you is approximations for x and y as real numbers. So maybe if you took both of these and then viewed them as, like, typed them into your basic calculator, you'd probably just get some, you know, number and then some decimal places. It'll give you that information, but that's not enough unless you compute to huge precision to recover these x and y in practice. For smaller values it is, but in general it's very hard. Okay, so here's a computer from the 1960s that Birch and Swinnerton Dyer, these are two British mathematicians who were at Cambridge University at the time, they were very curious about exactly the same question you asked, Neil, which is, you have an elliptic curve, does it have infinitely many points or not? Why do some curves have lots and lots of solutions? Why for some values of A and B do you get lots of solutions, and for other values of A and B you don't get it, you just get a few? How can you distinguish one from the other quickly? So they took this computer and they did calculations to try to figure out the answer. So here's the sort of calculation they did. So let's say somebody gives you some elliptic curve. I'll give you one at random. Y squared equals x cubed plus, actually, somebody yell at a random number with like three digits. 743. What's yours?
721.
Oh, yes. So it's probably an elliptic curve. it's kind of hard, maybe if you don't really know anything about what's going on, it's kind of hard to even contemplate looking for solutions to this or trying to show anything. But there's something that's very easy that you could do. If you're just like, well, you know, I just want to solve, you know, there's always a thing where if you can't solve something easier. So instead of trying to find all solutions to this, by which I mean finding a finite list of solutions, so every other solution can be got by the secant process or the tangent process from this, from your list of solutions, you could instead just take the coefficients of the equation, reduce it modulo a small prime, like 7, and then find all the solutions there. So it's somehow like an easy practice problem. Given the equation, instead you could take it and reduce it mod 7 and try to find the solutions. So you could reduce mod 7. And then it doesn't seem like such a hard problem to find all the solutions where, by mod 7, I mean you just take the number, divide by 7, and take the remainder, and list the solutions between 0 and 6 inclusive that satisfy the equation modulo 7. So this is the running example curve that we considered as we went. I'll return to the curve over there in a second. So what I've done here is I've drawn a big bold blue dot at each solution point to that equation modulo 7. So let's check that one of these is right. So let's take the point x is 2 and y is 4. Let's verify that that satisfies this equation modulo 7. So if you plug in x equal to 2 on the right hand side, you get 8 minus 2, which is 6. And if you plug in y equals 4, you get 16 plus 4, which is 20. And the question is, are these congruent modulo 7? And they are, because the difference is 14, which is divisible by 7. So this is, in fact, a solution. And I've drawn all dots for all of the solutions. I just systematically looped through pairs x, y and asked, does it satisfy the equation? And those are all the solutions. There are 9 of them, so we have quite a lot. So what Bertrand Sorens and Dyer did was they had the following heuristic. They said, well, we'd really like to be able to decide in some way whether or not, given input, an elliptic curve, so an equation y squared equals x cubed plus ax plus b, we want to know whether or not there are infinitely many solutions to this equation. So sometimes there are and sometimes there aren't, and maybe there's something really interesting going on that distinguishes them. So here's our heuristic. Let's imagine there were infinitely many solutions. Then, if we count the number of points mod p for lots of different prime numbers p, we'll probably tend to get a lot of numbers mod, we'll get a lot of solutions mod p compared to average. So when you reduce modulo 7, 11, 13, and so on, if this has lots and lots of solutions, then you'd maybe expect to find lots of solutions mod each prime p. Because, after all, if you have a solution here, in most cases, as long as the x and y coordinates have denominator coprime to the prime, you get a solution down here. So that's their idea. They'll count the number of solutions for lots of different prime numbers p, and if the number of solutions looks a bit bigger than you might expect on average, then they'll say maybe this probably has a lot of solutions to it. Maybe it has infinitely many. Whereas if the number looks maybe a little small, the number of points that you find mod p looks really small, then maybe this curve doesn't have infinitely many points on it. So it's a very, very loose heuristic, but amazingly, you can turn it into a precise statement about the analytic behavior at a certain point of a function that looks like the Riemann zeta function that is attached to an elliptic curve. So you can make what was extremely vague, but just a sort of heuristic idea, into a very precise statement. Here's another picture of Bertrand Sorens and Dyer. This is my favorite. I took this of him. I was very lucky. That's Sorens and Dyer. He was holding a newspaper which said, I didn't post this or anything, he just happened to be holding a paper which said, stand and be counted. Apparently it's going to be published in La Recherche. I found out about this, even though they didn't contact me or ask permission, but I found out about it from somebody, that it will be published in this French magazine. There's an article about this conjecture in this popular magazine. So, here are the numbers you get. By the way, I kept saying on average, you know, how many points are there on average? So there's a theorem of Hasse that if you let AP be P plus 1 minus the number of points, remember the number of points mod 7 in our particular example is 9. So P plus 1, 8 minus 9, that's minus 1. But you can define these numbers A sub P for all prime numbers P. You have to be careful if P divides the...
if the reduced curve is not an elliptic curve, but I'll push that aside for the moment. You define these numbers A sub P, and they're at most 2 square root of P. So that is to say, the number of points is very close to P plus 1, and the error is at most 2 square root of P. So they appear all over the place around P plus 1, but
there's a bounded error. So erase that. So if you take lots of elliptic curves and reduce the modulo of prime P, and then look at the number of points you get, it's some collection of numbers, and they're close to P plus 1. They lie in this interval from P plus 1 minus 2 root P to P plus 1 plus 2 root P. So there's this little bounded interval in which all of the counts will lie. And it's something you can observe if you just write down curves, you'll find that in fact they do lie in this bound. And
there's a fairly natural proof of this fact. We have to develop a whole bunch of structure on elliptic curves to understand it. You really have to, basically, you define a certain map called the Frobenius map on the points of an elliptic curve modulo P, and then you develop the theory, the natural properties that it has, and then this statement falls out very easily. But to develop those properties takes some work. But in any case, the statement's clear. It's just that the number of points modulo P, when you count the solutions, if you make the graph like I made before, the number of big blue dots that you'll draw is in this interval. It's bounded. So it's a good thing to consider these numbers. When they're negative, that means that N of P is a little bit bigger than P plus 1. So you might think if the A sub P tend to be negative, then maybe your curve has a lot of points. And look in our particular example. This was a curve that had infinitely many points on it. I was showing you lots of different points. I was writing them down here. I didn't prove that they're infinitely many, but you know, here are a lot of points. That's a point on this curve. And indeed, these A sub P are negative. That is, they're a little bit bigger than P plus 1 for quite a lot of the A sub P. Eventually, you might see some that are less than P plus 1, but quite a lot of them are a little bit bigger than P plus 1. We can look at these same numbers for the curve. I'm going to go back for a second. Remember I mentioned that this curve, y squared plus y equals x cubed minus x squared, had only 5 points on it. Let's compute the numbers A sub P for this other curve and see if they tend to be a little bit, if they tend to be negative or not. I don't know, actually. I'm just curious. So there's some notation to enter elliptic curves in this program, which is, let's see, hopefully that's right. You can just print it out to see. No, I get that wrong. Sorry. Okay, is that the right equation? Y squared plus y equals x cubed minus x squared. Yes. Yeah. No, no, but I want this one. Sorry. Yeah. Thank you. But I want this one. Okay. So now there's this command AP. I think that AP. Well, AP. So you give it a number, and it gives you the AP. These are tending to be negative two. Ah, but look at A5 already is positive. A11 is positive. So they're not, before, remember, everything was negative up to 23. In this case, there are some that are negative, but already there are some that are positive. So, okay, these.
Okay, I'm just typing something. That gives a list of the AP, say up to 50, for the curve that has only 3 points on it. And then this is a list for the curve that has infinitely many points. So the ones on the bottom tend to be more negative than the ones on the top. But it's really hard to tell. I mean, what is going on here? It's not clear at all what the pattern is, or even what you should guess. So here's how you introduce some, well, there's a way to introduce some really nice structure on all of this that reminds one of the Riemann zeta function. So you define a function as follows. There should be a not divides here. So that's a type, well, it's not really a typo. It's forgetting to include a LaTeX makeup package. So this is just a restriction on which primes you consider. So just ignore that for a moment and imagine that you can find these for all primes. It doesn't really matter if you get things wrong for some finite number of primes. Okay, so you take these A sub p and you formally create this infinite product, 1 over 1 minus AP times p to the minus s plus p times p to the minus 2s. So what I mean by this is the following. It's a function. You can imagine plugging in a number for s, for example, 5. And then the result of the function is you take this product, and it's there are infinitely many terms in the product, but you can imagine approximating the function better and better, and it would converge for at least a sufficiently large s. You plug it in, so you have p to the minus 5 here, p to the minus 10 here, and on the bottom you get some rational number, and then you take 1 over that, and you add that into your infinite product. So it's just a formal way of combining together these a sub p and some function. And again, remember, a sub p is simply the measure of the difference between p plus 1 and the number of points modulo p. And a reason to consider this is that formally, if you substitute 1 in for s, and it turns out that's very hard to make sense of, but formally it's the product of p divided by n sub p, where n sub p denotes the number of points mod p. So this is a function, L star ES, which makes sense for at least s sufficiently large. And I'll show you some graphs of this function. You can draw nice graphs of it. You can prove that it has nice behavior. But it's a function so that if formally you consider its value at the point 1, you get this infinite product. And this infinite product, well, if n of p were a bit bigger than p on average, you might imagine that this infinite product would be 0. Whereas if n of p were smaller than p on average, you might imagine that this is pretty big. So it's at least some way of slightly making more rigorous this idea that you can count the number of points by lots of primes and then get some information about the elliptic curve. Instead of doing that, you count the number of points, assemble together this function, and then somehow try to make sense of the function at 1, and then the conjecture will be that this function vanishes at 1, precisely when there are infinitely many solutions to the elliptic curve equation. That's the conjecture of Birch and Smirnoff and Dyer. Yes?
Question. So yes. You're defining it formally by the product on the top.
Yes.
And then when you're evaluating
this is,
one, are you going to look at like the
analytic completely, yes, this is completely heuristic. This doesn't mean anything.
Okay.
In fact, there's a theorem that if it means something, then it gives you the wrong number. It doesn't give you the value that you get at the analytic continuation.
Okay, so by vanishing at 1, I mean what you said.
So the precise meaning is the following. You have a bunch of integers, a sub p. You assemble together this product. It defines an analytic function on some right half plane. And it's a theorem of Weyl, of Andrew Weyl's, Bray, Conrad, Diamond, and Taylor, that analytic function on some right half plane, that is for s sufficiently to the right in the complex plane, it extends to a function that has nice behavior and is analytic on the whole complex plane.
Okay.
And then the value of 1 is by definition about, no poles at all. And it has for people that know absolutely no complex analysis at all, you can consider functions on the complex numbers. So there's a very quick definition of analytic. So consider a function from the complex numbers to the complex numbers. And remember in calculus, for functions over real variables, often very useful to consider their Taylor expansion. So a function is analytic if at every point there's some neighborhood where it's given by a power series. It's determined by its Taylor expansion everywhere in a neighborhood of a point. So it's a very, very quick definition of analytic. They're the nicest complex functions, and they have
extremely nice properties, much better than even a real analysis. And the amazing thing is that if you consider the function that's given by this infinite product, and this infinite product only sort of defines a function when the S is sufficiently far to the right in the complex plane, it can be analytically continued to the whole complex plane. That's almost equivalent to the statement that every elliptic curve over Q is modular. It's implied by the modularity theorem that Wiles et al. Proved, but it does not imply it. It's a weaker statement.
But this is the L function elliptic curve. I'll show you some. I'll show you a graph or a couple of graphs of it, just to give it a little more concrete feel to you. Here's a graph. So I took this function for the for S over here. I'm just plugging in real numbers, and I'm getting out real numbers. For S over here, you could just literally take the infinite product, count the number of points on the curve mod, a whole bunch of different points, and multiply it out, and you get some number that would start converging. You get some list of numbers that starts converging, and using much better methods than that, you compute here. Also, using that this is modular, you can efficiently compute its values all over the place, and you get a graph that looks like this. Here's some other graphs of L functions of elliptic curves. Oh, by the way, in the previous graph, notice that it does vanish at 1. If you were to draw the graph like this for the other curve that I showed you, you'd find that it doesn't vanish at 1. Right here, it would maybe be right here. These are other examples of graphs of L series of elliptic curves. And you can see that the order of vanishing can be higher than 1 of the function at 1. So you have this L series, and you can ask, is the number of points on the elliptic curve infinite or finite? Are there infinitely many solutions? And there's a conjecture. This conjecture is that there are infinitely many exactly when this function L of ES vanishes at 1. But moreover, you can tell something about how many solutions there are by considering the order of vanishing of this function. So right here, this pink line, that has order of vanishing 3 at that point. And it turns out that indeed, if you look at the look at the elliptic curve that defines this this function, then it does have, well, not only does it have infinitely many solutions, there are 3 points, so that every solution can be got from those 3 points using secants and tangents. And that's the minimum number that does it. You really need 3 distinct points. And there's that, remember there's some curve of rank 24. Presumably, if you drew the graph, you'd find something that vanishes to the order of 24. The L series is a complex valued function of a complex variable. You can plug in complex values for S. And this is an example of what the graph looks like in the complex plane. So what I've graphed is the absolute value of the L series of our curve, and the dark numbers are small, and the red numbers are large. So it looks like it vanishes at S equal to 1 in the complex plane. So these guys did these computations, Bertrand Smerts and Dyer, and experimentally they detected certain relations between different numbers that you can attach to an elliptic curve. So they started really getting an idea of what's going on. One, they said that this function should vanish at 1 precisely when there are infinitely many solutions to the equation. But they also, there are a whole bunch of different objects and numbers that you can attach to an elliptic curve, and they put them all together in a big package and got a conjectural formula, which they refined by computations. Here's, again, the statement of the conjecture. Not only is it the statement that the equation has infinitely many solutions precisely when L of E S equals 1 at S equal, I mean equals 0 at S equal to 1, but moreover, the order of vanishing of the function, that is, if you look at the Taylor expansion about S equal to 1 of this function, it'll start out with S to the R plus higher, well, there's a coefficient here, S to the R plus higher order terms. And this R, that should be the number of independent points needed to generate all the solutions to the equation. By the way, this statement, exactly as I've made it, if you prove it, you win $1 million. So it's a $1 million prize problem from the Clay Math Institute. Exactly this question. Show that the number of points needed to solve this equation
is equal to the order of vanishing of the function at s equal to 1.
There's a theorem in this direction. If the order of vanishing is either 0 or 1, then it's true. The number of points is equal to the order of vanishing.
So if you write down an elliptic curve, and by some method you can show that L of U1 is not 0, you know that there are only finitely many solutions to that equation.
For example, if we take the curve we were considering before, this one, and I have a command L series at 1. It evaluates the L series at 1. And it gives me 0.2538 and so on. That is not 0. There's an error bound. That the second thing returned is the error bound, which is less than 0.25. Therefore, the L function is not 0 at 1. And by this theorem of Kalibagan, Gross, and Zagier, you know that the number of points is finite. So there's that. But if the order of vanishing were 2 or bigger, you know absolutely nothing. The theorem gives you absolutely nothing. It's only when it's less than or equal to 1. Okay, so I'm going to stop for today and pick up on this next time. So the rest of this lecture, which I'll start on Wednesday, will be about what it means for an elliptic curve to be modular, and what a modular form is, and how to compute them. And then I'll start more formally with
discussion of the group box. So there are 20 questions or comments. Still 1 minute left in case anybody wants to ask anything.
Okay, so I'll see you on Wednesday. How many of you are going to... Sorry, I had an announcement. If you want to register for this course and you're a graduate student, you have to go see Scott on the 7th floor. You can't register online, apparently.
Do you want us to register?
Yes, because if you don't, it'll be canceled. It'll be canceled if you don't register.
Okay.
Because there are 4 undergrads registered, and the course will definitely be canceled if grad students don't register. Do you have a conflict that doesn't allow you to register? Or?
No, I'm just like...
So please, I beg you to register if you're a grad student, because otherwise the class will actually be canceled due to lack of enrollment. But I'll sign anything necessary for that.
I was the one to email you.
Oh, right.
I wanted to make an appointment for you.
Sure.
For some time.
Yep. Let's.
I won't be here tomorrow.
Okay. What's your name?
Amanda.
Anna?
Amanda.
Oh, I met you at the registers. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't recognize you for some reason. Now that I can see and it's not so bright up. Yeah.
So calculating the torsion group is completely algorithmic now or not?
Yes, the torsion subgroup is algorithmic. And in fact, there's this guy at USC, he's like a second year grad student, and he's been doing some of his thesis work so far on calculating the torsion subgroup. And he's actually coming by tomorrow to talk with me about it. So it's still an interesting question. There are recent papers about it. There's actually a fairly naive method that comes from something called the Lutz-Nagel, algorithm. It's really exactly the analog of the rational root theorem, except in a much more complicated context. But it's slow because you have to factor things and run through divisors, and there are much better methods than that. There are better methods. Yeah. So calculating the torsion subgroup you can do.
Yes.
Yeah, and there's also a finite list of possibilities. Maser in the 70s classified all of them. Mm-hmm. But the the rank, so the group modulo torsion, that's the hard one. That's really the hard one. So any other comments or questions?
I actually have a quick question. So you're saying you want all the grad students to register for the class.
Yeah.
But we don't have to, if we show up, or what else do we have to? Because I kind of feel loaded down right now, but I want to come to
grad
the class.
Grad students will get an A unless they do ops. And I mean, just show up and put in some comments and stuff.
Okay.
The undergrads, it'll be like the normal thing, but for grad students, you don't have to really do anything. I'll put that in writing more precisely in case you're worried. But,
I'll definitely show up. So.
Okay. Yeah, it's really a problem. So, but I was supposed to teach a grad course, and there was some confusion in scheduling. And so
And they give this other guy a course, and only a few people signed up, and it was at the same time as Stark's course. So it was all good. Yeah. So I need some grad students to register, otherwise it would be canceled.
Okay. So, I'll do that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, see you later.
So I need to.
It's a pretty cool opportunity for undergrads.
Yeah, I think so. And it'll also help keep me from saying too much to grad students by having undergrads. Ooh, that's really unpleasant to look at. Sorry, I want to actually be able to see my screen in order to. That's the right resolution, okay. Yes.
Ah. And then maybe when we meet, you can help me install Sage. I tried to over the weekend, but I have OS X.
Oh wow, I've never. Everybody I know who uses it compiles it from source on OS 10. But I always build binaries, yeah. But I've never actually had anyone try to use one.
Okay.
So I'm very interested to see what fails. I tried installing the Windows binary and had some problem with it. So also, I think that probably for OS 10 there's a really standard way to do installation of software, which I don't know anything about, which maybe we can discuss.
Because I
don't really use OS 10 except by logging in remotely to some machine, and then for me it's just like a Unix machine.
Right.
Okay, so calendar. So now I can finally schedule. What about tomorrow at 3?
I won't be here tomorrow.
Okay, yeah, that's what you said. Sorry. Thursday.
Thursday I'm busy from 3 to 7 in the section.
Wow.
I can do like.
There's a number 3 seminar. What about Friday? There's no class in here on Friday. What about four, a little after 4 on Friday? Friday afternoon? Or do you want to, maybe 1? Are you going to Stark's class?
Yeah.
We can meet like a half hour before Stark's class.
Okay.
On Friday at 1:30. Well, maybe let's make it 1 so they'll have more time.
1? Okay.
Yeah.
I can do that.
So 1 to 2. What's your name again?
Neil.
Oh. Okay. How, do you spell it like that or?
A.
Okay.
Yeah.
Last
Harris. One.
Harris. Okay. Chris, your email is. Meet in the office. So my office is 5111.
Okay.
Okay, so I'll see you on Friday an hour before Stark.
Alright. Thanks a lot.
Okay, so what do you want to talk about? So one is installing Sage for OS 10.
No, one's installing Sage. And then just like in general.
Which is it OS 10 10.3 or 10.4? Okay, 10.4. Okay, and then what are the things? Like general ideas for research projects?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know how soon I should be doing that. I mean, I know like a lot of first years don't get into that.
My opinion is from freshman year of freshman year of high school. No, I think some of the best research I directed in the last few years has been freshman undergrads. So I don't think there's any time that's too early.
You work at CCR, right?
Yes, that's correct. Do you work there?
No, I worked at Fort Meade for the last 2 summers.
You were a grad student, so it wasn't the.
I wasn't in the GMP or the DSP or anything. I was working there.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to ask if, because I emailed Joe Bueller about a job over at CCR this summer, but never got back to me. I wanted to see if you had any contacts or anything. So,
yeah.
I mean, I don't really want to go back to Fort Meade next summer.
Yeah, CCR is like way better. Yeah.
I like San Diego. I'm from San Diego too. But.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know anything.
Occasionally, there haven't been many grad students, but there's one girl, that Kaylee, who I've seen over there a few times. So I think Lance Small brought her over.
Okay.
So it's certainly possible. And there's another guy.
And
there's a couple of grad students who do come there for some amount of time. So I'll see what I can do.
Yeah. All right.
Cool.
Yeah, good lecture. It's really
thanks.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah. So it's going to be tricky though. I have to somehow go from this to very elementary stuff to make sure that I don't exclude the undergrads.
Right.
But I think today is just about motivating why you care about any of this stuff. So, I haven't mentioned the cryptography stuff, which is very, very relevant. So I'll see you on Wednesday and then on Friday.
And a quick question about Sage also.
Yes.
Is there a particular reason why I should be using Sage over like Magma or something if I have Magma?
Depends what you're doing, but I would personally, if what you're
You should use both if you have them, because it's good to know two different systems that can do similar things. But the main thing is I've been writing Sage from scratch for about a year and a half now, and it's open source, free, and will hopefully in some ways be better than Magma.
That'd be nice.
So those are the...
Instead of $100 for...
Yeah, exactly. Well, the $100 student version of Magma is extremely crippled. You're limited to use it most 128 megs of memory, which is...
It's a
total killer for Mac. So, and then the non-crippled version is like $1,000 at least or something, so... Compared to free, but the open source part is much more important for math, I think. Because,
in Sage, if you want to see the source code for something, first if you say one question mark after a function you're going to call, it gives you the documentation, which isn't that amazing. But if you put two question marks, it gives you the source code. Maybe resizing the window isn't a good idea. Let me try it in another window. L series at one. So you get the actual source code for the function, and everything's open. So you wonder, what exactly is it doing? And there it is. It tells you exactly what it's doing. Whereas with Magma, the source is closed.
Yeah,
and plus it's hard to figure out where things are. Even the parts that are there, it's hard to see where they're defined. Here, when you ask for the documentation, it tells you right here exactly what file it's in. So you can open that in the editor and view it, and see what other functions are defined in the same context. Plus, if you learn, so Sage is much, much less mature than Magma. Magma's been around for like 20 years, and Sage has been around for like 20 months or less, I mean, since its conception. But there's a lot of stuff that needs to be implemented in Sage, and you could help me with that or help me with developing algorithms that would go into Sage. Whereas if you use Magma, you know, it's not so direct of a route to be able to improve some product.
So we'll go to Sage or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
So those are some reasons. But I'll say more about that when I demo Sage, hopefully on Wednesday for the class.
All right, Okay. Sounds good.
Yep.
See you Wednesday. Thanks a lot.
All right, see you later, Neil, with an A. So we're going to meet right now.
Do you want some time just to relax or whatever after that?
No. Okay. We can just meet now instead of waiting until 5. Yeah.